It's All Things Considered on Vermont Public Radio. Good evening. I'm Peter Biello. Fans of Guilford author Michael Nethercott's first novel, The Seance Society, will be happy to know that the so-called odd couple sleuths, Lee Plunkett and Mr. O'Nelligan, have returned. His new novel, The Haunting Ballad, takes place in Greenwich Village in 1957. The folk singer Lorraine Cobble has fallen to her death from the roof of her apartment building. Did she jump, or was she pushed? Nethercott joins us now to talk about the book. Welcome.
Hello, Peter.
So this odd couple pair of detectives, Lee Plunkett and Mr. O'Nelligan, your protagonists, they kind of seem to turn the whole Sherlock Holmes-Watson dynamic on its head, don't they?
Yeah, in a sense. We have Lee Plunkett is, he's a young, not the most skilled private eye. He basically inherited the business from his father, who was a real rough and tumble kind of guy. And Lee, for reasons he's never quite sure of himself, decides to carry on the family business. But he does have Mr. O'Nelligan. Mr. O'Nelligan is an older man. He's in his early 60s, probably. He is a transplant from Ireland. And Mr. O'Nelligan is very erudite. He loves to quote William Butler Yeats and Shakespeare, a very scholarly kind of guy. And he's got a long list of what he had done in his life for his jobs. He'd been an actor. He'd been a teacher. He'd been a bricklayer. He was an Irish rebel. So, so their combination does kind of twist the whole Sherlock Watson thing, because even though Lee is the one who has the official PI license, it's really O'Nelligan who has the deductive chops and is best suited to figure out things.
Overall, the book has a very noir feel, and I'm wondering if you could read a short passage to give our listeners a sense of how the book sounds.
Well, I'll give a little piece here that gives some flavor of the relationship and the banter between Lee Plunkett and Mr. O'Nelligan. Lee is our narrator. So at this point, they've decided they're going to investigate this case, the murder, well, potential murder, we'll say, of Lorraine Cobble, who was a collector of folk songs. And at this point, they're driving down Route 7 toward the Merritt Parkway. So this is in 1957. And Mr. O'Nelligan speaks. "A fine spring day, isn't it?" He was dressed nattily in his standard vest and necktie, a splendid beginning to a quest. "Listen, this is no quest," I grumbled. "We're just going to meet a potential client, accent on potential. Why is everything always a quest with you?" "All life is a quest, lad. One merely needs to recognize it as such." Somehow, in Mr. O'Nelligan's eyes, I had maintained my stature as lad, even though I'd passed the 30 mark. "The thing is," I said, "I'm not at all sure that there's even a case here. We may be talking simple suicide." The Irishman clicked his tongue. "Ah, but suicide is never simple. Back home in County Kerry, there was a miller by the name of Blowick who drowned himself in the River Firth. It was near the end of March, and he had to hurl himself into the freezing waters to meet his end. No one could figure out the why of it till much later, when someone put together that March 29, the day he perished, was the feast of St. Ethna, and that in his youth, poor Blowick had loved and lost a girl named Ethne O'Mara. So you see, there is oft a hidden complexity to these things. If I might quote Yeats, couldn't stop you if I tried. My friend always seemed to have a handy quote from his favorite poet and fellow countryman, William Butler Yeats. He now let one fly. A pity beyond all telling is hid in the heart of love.
That, like so many conversations, sounds so much like a father and son conversation.
Yeah. Lee's relationship with his actual father, who died maybe a year and a half, 2 years before the action in the story. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't close, even for the year and a half that they worked together in the Plunkett and Son agency. With Mr. O'Nelligan, he certainly is a father figure to him, and he's guiding him. O'Nelligan is guiding Lee through his chosen profession, the detective work. And Lee, it's not that Lee is totally at sea with it, with the detective work. He takes good notes. He's a good questioner. You're the radio guy.
He's inquisitive to a point.
He's inquisitive.
You know, he doesn't go too far. He'll get so far. And I remember at one point he says, "Well, I had more questions, but it didn't seem like anybody wanted to be asked any questions, so I just gave up."
Right. That's
what is he doing?
And that's where back to your original observation. So even though Lee should be the Holmes of the pair, he's really more of the Watson. He's the one who's telling us the account of how Mr. O'Nelligan solved the mystery.
It's a whodunit, and I won't spoil the ending.
Good.
But, yeah, don't want to spoil it for the readers. But I will ask you how you, as a writer, go about creating that sense of suspense. You know, how do you make sure that we don't lose interest in the central question of the book, which is, who killed Lorraine Cobble?
As a writer, as a reader and as a writer, I was always drawn to multiple characters, lots of suspects, and hopefully colorful suspects. So as a writer, that's what I try to bring to these whodunits, that there's a number of characters, and that they're all varied enough from each other. And you know, some are pretty quirky, some are very quirky, some are not. You know, some are more down-to-earth folks. Just as in life, you meet a mix of people. And as a reader, I've always been a little put off when I'd read a book and the culprit in a whodunit turned out to be someone who had been barely mentioned or, you know, was passingly referenced on page 60. And so I tried to make it someone who, in some form, we've had a relationship with.
It's funny you mentioned that because when I was reading the book, there was one character who was mentioned maybe in one sentence
in
early in the book. And I thought, oh, that's, you know, he was described as a Groucho Marx kind of character. And I thought, that's got to be a significant detail. And I kept looking for that guy as the book progressed because I thought, you know, he's going to be lurking in a shadow somewhere. We're going to see the cigar and the mustache eventually again. You know what I mean? That wasn't the case, apparently, I guess, because that, as for you as a reader, that's an annoying thing when authors do that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. Groucho Marx is a killer? I don't know. I might make an exception on that one. I don't know. I was actually glad that you latched onto that because it was just a passing reference, just a little bit of color for that paragraph.
This book was set in 1957. Why not set it in 2014?
Well, my short answer for that is always because I don't want to have to keep calling up my young adult children and asking them every time I make a reference to a smartphone or something on the internet. I'm not the most tech-savvy dude, so the idea of using a time and place where I understand the technology is a plus. But more than that, the 50s, they've always struck me as an interesting time. We were coming after the Second World War. You had the so the inflow of the returning soldiers and the GI Bill, guys were buying houses. It seems like it's a rich arena of different things happening, of different social movements and cultural shifts, and a good place to set a mystery.
The title, The Haunting Ballad, refers to the songs that the murdered character, Lorraine, claims to receive through a woman who can channel dead folk singers. What was your inspiration for that part?
I always have some kind of supernatural piece in these O'Neilligan and Plunkett stories. And I don't know, you know, I just came up with that idea that there'd be a character, Mrs. Padenshell, who claims that she receives songs from the dead and can then sing them back to the living. When I wrote it, I'm not sure quite how I came to that character. Though afterwards, I remembered from some reading I was doing that there was a woman in the 70s named Rosemary Brown, who was English. And she claimed that she received songs from dead classical composers, Bach and Beethoven and Schubert and Liszt and all. And, I mean, she was dismissed pretty much by any serious musicologist. But, you know, I think she cut a couple albums and she had a bit of a following. But at least my conscious mind wasn't remembering her while I was writing this. I wanted something tied in with music, but to have a supernatural bent to it.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for talking to me about The Haunting Ballad.
Hey, thank you.
And since songs weighed so heavily in this book, I was wondering if you could take us out with one of the songs, maybe one of the ones you used as an epigraph for one of the chapters.
Sure. This is actually a old Appalachian tune that has many variations. Oh, death. Oh, death, won't you pass me over till another year? Now, what is this that I can't see with ice-cold hands taking hold of me? Well, I am death, none can excel. I'll open the gates to heaven or hell. Oh, death, someone would pray, can't you wait to call me another day?